Good day, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to the ins and outs of conducting a self-evaluation for local government conference call. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. Later, we will conduct a question-and-answer session, and instructions will follow at that time. If anyone should require operator assistance during the conference, please press star and then zero on your touch-tone telephone. As a reminder, this conference call is being recorded. I would now like to turn the call over to your host, Ms. Robin Jones. Please go ahead.
Well, good afternoon or good morning to everyone and wherever you may be connecting with us today. My name is Robin Jones, and I am the director of the Great Lakes ADA Center, which is one of the 10 federally funded regional technical assistance centers on the Americans with Disabilities Act and a member of the ADA National Network. Today's program is being brought to you as part of the collaborative efforts of the ADA National Network to bring training and technical assistance to people in our communities on topics that are relevant to you. In a few moments, I will be introducing our speakers for today's session, but I just want to cover a few of the technical issues before we start today. Please know that this session is being recorded, and a written transcript, as well as the recording of today's session, will be made available on our website at www.ada-audio.org under the ADA Audio Conference Series section, Archives. That should be up within approximately 5 business days after we've been able to edit the transcript and get it posted. So if you wanted to review something or you want to refer another colleague or somebody to it, you can do it through that particular process. We have individuals joining us today using a mode of different modes of technology. We have individuals on the telephone. We also have individuals who are using streaming audio on the Internet. And we have individuals who are using real-time captioning streamed on the Internet. During the question and answer period, the operator will be giving instructions to those that are on the telephone on how to ask questions. Individuals who are using streaming audio and or captioning would use the instructions that were provided to them in regards to how to go about provide an advance into how to submit questions, and we will be addressing all of your questions as much as time permits us to do so today. It is rather timely, I want to say, that we are addressing this particular topic today as it is March 15th of 2011, which is the effective date for the Title II and Title III regulations that were issued on September 15th of 2010. So it's with that in mind that we will be going forward today talking about what really does a Title II entity need to think about in regards to ensuring that they are not only compliant with the regulations that were effective in January 26th of 1992, but also what does that mean for me now that we have some revisions to the ADA, the first major revision to the ADA since its implementation about 18 years ago. So I think that I didn't really think about that when we planned the session for this month, but it is serendipitous that that's actually what occurred. We are very honored and privileged today to have with us two highly qualified speakers to address this topic with us. First, I want to introduce Irene Bowen. Irene Bowen is the owner and operator of a consulting company known as ADA One. She is a nationally recognized consultant, trainer, and speaker. But before starting her firm in 2009, she was the deputy chief of the Disability Rights Section at the Department of Justice. In that role, she oversaw enforcement of the ADA and was actively involved in the development of the original ADA accessibility guidelines, as well as the Department of Justice's Title II and Title III regulations and the revisions to them. So Irene lived with these regulations close to her heart and in her briefcase and in her desk and piles of paper for many, many years before she retired, and was happy to see them actually come into print in 2010. Many of her clients now in the private sector include local governments, colleges and universities, places of public accommodation, as well as federal agency. She works closely in teams with an architecture firm called LCM Architects and other entities to assist them in developing cost-effective approaches to the compliance. She recently has, to her credits, a ADA guide for nonprofits that was issued and commissioned by the Chicago Community Trust, and it was issued in January of 2011. Prior to all of these things with the Department of Justice and her current ventures, she was the Deputy General Counsel of the U.S. Access Board and co-founder of the National Center for Law and Deafness. She is an attorney and received her degree from the George Washington University Law School. Our second presenter today is Sally Conway. Sally is with the U.S. Department of Justice Civil Rights Division, and she is currently serving as the deputy chief in that particular position, which is a recent promotion for her. She is assigned to the Disability Rights Section, which is responsible for providing technical assistance about the requirements of Title II and Title III of the ADA, and investigations, and where necessary, litigating Title I, II, and III complaints, and certifying state and local building codes. Sally's background is she has a bachelor's and master's degree in different fields. She's worked in disability rights and civil rights for more than 20 years. She's conducted training sessions, workshops, and presentations on the ADA in a multitude of areas far and wide across the country and beyond. And works closely with both public and private sectors related to those issues. She's responsible for the department's wide-reaching ADA technical assistance program, and that includes the Business Connection Program, the development of new technical assistance materials, the ADA information line that many of you may be familiar with, and that line and those services reach many, many people all over the place. She's also involved with a ADA mediation program, which is an option within the Department of Justice for businesses, state and local governments, and people with disabilities to use as an efficient, effective, and voluntary alternative to resolving complaints under the ADA. She serves as a congressional liaison for ADA and other disability-related matters. Prior to her life with the Department of Justice, she was the program director for Granite State Independent Living Center in New Hampshire, and she also has experience working as an investigator for the New Hampshire Commission on Civil Rights. So she has a vast background and experience in this area, and I think what you'll hear from both of our presenters today is some really common sense, common approaches to this particular issue based on their vast experience and the work that they've done with many, many other entities. So without further ado, and to make sure we get full use of our presenters and opportunity for access to all of you to ask questions today, I'm going to turn it over to Sally. And everyone should have the handout materials and be able to follow us along today as well. So go ahead. I'm sorry, not Sally. I'm handing it over to Irene. Don't want to throw you off there, the two of you. So I'm going to go ahead and hand it off at this time to Irene. Go ahead, Irene.
Thanks, Robin, and happy Ides of March to everyone. As Robin mentioned, the headline, I guess, today is that the new requirements are in effect under the Title II and Title III regulations. I'm thrilled to be here with both Robin and Sally and with all of you to sort of analyze what does this mean for all of us. And we're going to start on slide two with the legal mumbo-jumbo. I no longer give legal advice, and we want to make sure that you know that this presentation is not intended to give you legal advice, but general information that can be applied to specific fact patterns, and if you do need legal advice, there are plenty of people who are willing and able to give that. And on to slide number three. As Robin mentioned, this is really timely because the regulations become effective today, although the new standards, 2010 standards, don't take effect for purposes of alteration and new construction until next year on the Ides of March. But in general, as you know, the provisions about policy changes are in effect. Now, keep in mind that most of the provisions of the regulation from 1991 are still in effect. Not all of them have been changed, although, of course, we do have new standards and changes to certain sections of the 1991 regulations. And I know that you all are probably familiar with the basic requirements, the procedural requirements, but we're going to review those real quickly starting with slide three before we get to the specifics that of the changes that have been brought about, and Sally's going to make sure we all understand those very clearly before the hour and a half is over. But you're probably wondering things like, is a new self-evaluation required? Is a new transition plan required? If it's not, should state and local governments do them anyway? How do they go about it? And how do the new regulations affect the process? So those are the questions that we hope to answer today, starting with the basics, then the specifics of the DOJ provisions, and then the practicalities. So the DOJ regulation that was issued, as we have the citations to on slide number three, was issued in 1991, and it requires a self-evaluation of services, policies, and practices that was to be done within a year of the effective date of the regulation by January 1993. So that's, what, 18 years ago now. And those were to be kept on file for 3 years. So what that basically means is an evaluation of how you, not only what do you officially say are your policies, but what do you do on a day-to-day basis, and how does it affect people with disabilities, and how should your policies and practices be changed to avoid discrimination. And secondly, the 1991 regulation requires a transition plan, which means a plan that ensures that you don't have discrimination that results from inaccessible facilities. That plan basically is to include a list of people you consulted, the areas you examined, and the modifications that were planned to be made for the sake of physical access or program accessibility. It has to be done with public input, and if you have, it's to be available for inspection for the public. And moving on to slide number four, just briefly, some of the other procedural requirements besides the self-evaluation and transition plan are that the modifications that are required for program accessibility had to be completed within 3 years. You have to have a responsible official, which we usually call an ADA coordinator, if you have 50 or more employees, and that's the person who's responsible for overseeing compliance. And then there also has to be a grievance procedure if there are 50 or more employees. In other words, a way to file a complaint and a process for handling it. And then finally, the entity has to give notice to the public of what the ADA provisions are and how they apply to the entity. And in slide five, we've simply noted that Section 504 of the Rehabilitation Act also requires a self-evaluation and, if necessary, to ensure program accessibility, a transition plan. So let's go on to the specifics. Slide six lists what the regulation says has to be included in a transition plan. Now, before we get to the details here, remember that a transition plan explains how you're going to approach program accessibility, how you're going to ensure that you are not discriminating because of inaccessibility, physical inaccessibility of your facilities. And remember that you can do this by other means besides making changes to facilities. And the regulation tells you that program accessibility can be achieved by moving activities to accessible areas, by delivering services in other locations or to people in other locations, and through changes in policies and practices, by purchasing new equipment, et cetera. So that is one way of doing it, and then an alternative is making physical changes. Now, I think and I hope that we're seeing these other means being used less and less as time goes by as we see improved physical accessibility overall, but I did want to mention, I think we have to always mention this in any discussion about this, that there are options besides making physical changes to facilities. But if you do decide that you have to make changes, then this slide tells you what has to go into a transition plan. You have to describe what obstacles affect accessibility, and this is usually done building by building. And then you have to describe in detail how you're going to remove those barriers, when you're going to do it, and if it's going to take more than a year, you have to have annual markers. In other words, you have to say what you'll do each year. And then you have to name the person who's responsible for implementing the plan. So we ask a question in the next slide, slide 7. Why do a plan now? The 2010 regulation does not require a new transition plan or a new self-evaluation. But keep in mind, it requires compliance. You do have to comply with the regulation. So you may have done a transition plan when you were supposed to, 17 or 18 years ago. You may have made all the changes you were supposed to make through a self-evaluation and transition plan. But what if you haven't done anything since then? Think about what's changed and whether, if you haven't done an assessment of some sort, whether you can really still be complying. As you know, more and more people have disabilities, and more people with disabilities are using the services of state and local governments. We're up to about 18% of our population now being people with disabilities. And some of those disabilities are more severe than disabilities were 20 years ago. There are more types of disabilities, more diversity within the group of people with disabilities. And people with disabilities are using more technology and types of technology that didn't exist when you may have done your first self-evaluation and transition plan. And your programs have definitely changed. You offer more programs and activities if you're a state and local government than you did. These programs are offered in different ways, and as a result, the buildings and facilities are used in different ways. And one huge change that affects all of this is websites. They didn't exist when the first regulation was drafted. The first one came online about a year later, I believe. And it's definitely important to include an evaluation of your websites as a part of a self-evaluation. So all these things have changed, and if they haven't been reassessed, then it's not likely that you're in compliance. Then, of course, change continues. We have new regulations. We have increased enforcement from the Department of Justice, and Sally may want to speak to that. And we have tighter economic times. Whether or not that will get better, we don't know, but we do know that state and local governments are facing decreased resources and increased demands, at least over the next couple of years. So you have to ask yourself, can you comply without a plan? How do you get somewhere if you don't have a map or some kind of guidance for getting where you want to go? Which leads to another question in the next slide. Is it better not to assess the problems? Some people actually say, isn't it? Some people may think, well, if I know that I have a problem and I don't do anything about it, I'm probably in more trouble than if I wasn't aware of the problem. It's not really true, in my opinion. And the accelerator and the pedal there just sort of suggest problems that a car manufacturer, not to be mentioned, but a couple of years ago had some issues, partly because it is alleged that they didn't address issues that came to their attention, safety issues in their cars. And I think if you look at the history of what happened with that, it probably would have been better to address the issues when they came up, rather than allegedly ignoring them. Keeping your head in the sand, not a good idea. Having knowledge and dealing with it is a better idea. So even if the regulations don't require or no one suggests even that you do a self-evaluation or transition plan, there are certainly some benefits to doing a plan. And we list some of those in slide 9. First of all, it shows good faith and it shows an effort to comply with the regulations. Now, under Title III, which applies to private entities, good faith is a consideration that a judge is to take into account in imposing civil penalties. It's not specifically mentioned in Title II, but I think it is something that judges will look at, and it's also something that those who use your services will look at if they're deciding, if they have a complaint, how far they want to take it. In addition, it's important to meet the new deadlines, including the one today under the 2010 regulations. And keep in mind that there is always a possibility of harsher mandates from litigation. Basically, what this means is a judge can order you to do what you should have done in the first place. And if that happens, it can cost you more to comply with a court order than it would have cost you to comply in the first place. And that's taking into account the cost of damages and staff, lawyers, et cetera. And keep in mind, if you're not controlling your own destiny, if you're not in control of what you're doing and what your plans are and how you're going to comply, then that can cause extreme disruption to your internal processes. So it's better to be in control and to be doing the right thing without waiting for or taking the chance that someone is going to come along and file a complaint or file litigation against you. So with all that in mind, Sally is going to sort of walk us through the revisions that became effective today and the others that will become effective in a year, and what that means as you go through the process of doing a self-evaluation and transition plan. Sally.
Thank you, Irene. And happy March 15th, 2011, everyone. I'm going to talk a little bit about the regs, and well, I think what's important to know is why did we do what we did? You know, it was just, you know, people will say, oh, I just barely learned that, and now you're going to change it. The first thing, and I really need to echo what Irene said earlier, is that, yes, there have been some changes in the regs, and there have been some changes to the 2010 standards. But really, all of the fundamental underlying principles of the ADA, especially in Title II, things like, you know, program access, things like, you know, policy modifications and provision of effective communication, I mean, program access really hasn't changed, and that is such a fundamental concept, and that is something that as Title II entities, as you're looking at all of this stuff, you're going to have to figure out how do you make decisions, and we'll talk about that later on, for what needs to be done in terms of program access. And that's sometimes, I want to say right up front, it's a hard concept, especially when you're dealing with the new supplemental requirements. So we're going to talk about that. But my hope is that we have learned here at DOJ, learned a great many things in 20 years. And when you're stopped laughing, I'll continue. We realize, as Irene talked about, that technology has just incredibly changed the face of the United States, of the world. And it affects so many things. It affects ways in which we communicate. It affects how folks with disabilities are living longer with very significant disabilities, and they're increasingly independent because of the use of technology. And we also look at it in terms of, for instance, the service members, the young men and women who are returning from the conflicts or wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, who never would have survived even, you know, in the Gulf War of 1990. So we're seeing a whole change of types of disabilities, the longevity of folks with disabilities, and the way we do business. And if you are ever bored, you can take a look at the 1991 regs, and our biggest technological issue there was, I believe, the baud rate of modems. And I think that was the only reference to any technology. So we know the world has changed, and we know we got things wrong, and we know we needed to clarify things, and that's why we did this. And there's also a federal requirement that we periodically review our regulations, and we figure once every 19 years is periodically enough, considering how long it took. Yes, some parts of the regs are modified. There are new accessibility standards, and they're called the 2010 standards, and they basically incorporate the 2004 ADA guidelines that the Access Board created. But we have also added in the regulation language, there are a couple of things That if you looked at, I'll give you one that I know right off the top of my head, if you just looked at the standards, if you looked at, for instance, prison cells, in the standards it says 2% must be accessible. In the actual regulation, it says 3% need to be accessible. So you need to look at the standards not just as a document on its own, but where does, you know, what basis is in the regulation for getting us to the application of the standards. So don't just think of the standards for accessible design. Also think of them in terms of what do the regs say we have to do with those. So the effective date, and I know it's confusing because we use effective date and we also use compliance date. The effective date of the general non-discrimination provisions in the Title II and Title III regulations are today, March 15th, 2011. Now, one, there's a new provision for hotel reservation policies, and because that is dealing with very large nationwide reservation systems, we gave the hotels 18 months from the date that we published our regs, which will be March 15th, 2012, because there is a significant amount of work they need to do on software and establishing systems to meet that requirement. And the other, as Irene said, for the 2010 standards do not become enforceable for new construction and alterations until 2012, March 15th, 2012. So, the next slide, 11, Robin, I think. 2012 is the on-the-hook date for having to comply with the new standards for new construction, for alterations, to achieve program access through making structural modifications and barrier removal. Now, let me tell you one thing before we go on. That is the date that the standards are enforceable. And I want to give you as close to advice as I can legally do. And that is, don't wait until March 15th, 2012 to start looking at what you need to do. You need some time. That's exactly why that 18-month period was there, to allow people to do assessments and figure out what is it that they have to do, and to look at supplemental requirements. So waiting until, you know, March 14th, 2012, even though good faith effort is not specific in the Title II regs, that just wouldn't look good if somebody were to file a complaint. You are allowed to use the 2010 standards, and we'll talk about them in the next slide, but it's, you are required, those are the only standards for which you have to comply with as of March 2012. Slide 12. Okay. Here are the requirements for Title II entities. From now until March 15th, 2012, if you decide you need to make architectural changes to your existing facilities to meet program access, we have given you the option of choosing either to comply with either the 1991 standards, now legally those are the ones that are still in effect, or UFAS, the Uniform Federal Accessibility Standards, which some of you folks may have used when you were complying with 504, or the 2010 standards. So between now and March of 2012, you can choose any of those three to use. However, that choice is gone on March 15th, 2012. And that's a really important thing to know, because you need to think about which one, given your current situation, which one works the best for us. Because if you wait until 2012, you can't make that educated choice any longer. Now, the infamous supplemental requirements, and these are requirements that are in the 2010 standards, but and this is for the first time that we have addressed these specific issues and elements. They were not in the 1991 standards, so they are brand new requirements. So you need to look at those, and these are things like swimming pools, play areas, shooting ranges with firing positions, access to team seating and player seating, accessible route to court sports and those kinds of things, wading pools, spas, and like things like saunas. There's a whole list of them. These are brand new things for you. And what you need to do is you have, really, March 15th, 2012 is your ticking date. And you need to look at those things that you might already have. And face it, most Title II entities have some swimming pools. And there is a requirement now that there be in excess of 300 linear feet that you provide two accessible means of entry and egress. And we didn't have anything before in these. You need to be looking now at your swimming program or your pool program for your entity and figure out what you need to do to change things to meet those requirements. And you do those to the 2010 standards because they don't exist elsewhere. Next slide, number 13. Existing facility, I mean, there were a number of things that were added to the Title II regulation that for whatever reason weren't in it before. And we have added a very specific definition of existing facility, which basically means it's a facility that is in existence on any given date without regard to whether the facility may also be considered newly constructed or altered. And I know for some of you that's like, well, duh, but when we were beginning and it sort of stuck, that's always been the department's reading of what an existing facility is. But in practice, what happened before, you know, in 1992 and 1993, the first question that was asked when somebody called us about complying with the 91 standards was, oh, is this an existing facility or new construction? Because starting back then, we were sort of all on the same footing, and that was a way of saying existing, oh, it's program access or barrier removal, and new construction, you have to comply. This basically means any facility that you have that is in existence and that it's occupied. So if you build a building, a brandy new building, in June of 2012, that is, on that date, that is an existing facility because it is a facility that is there, irrespective of whether it's new construction or not. So we added that definition. In terms of compliance for program access, if you have to do architectural changes, you have to meet the standards in before 2012, in whichever standard you use, for alterations. But you would not be required to exceed those standards. And the question here on this slide is perfect. So what the heck if the measure changes? And some measures have changed. Slide 14. There are two different kinds of changes in the standards. One is incremental changes, and the other is we refer to those as the supplemental requirements. So those are new requirements that didn't exist before. And incremental changes are things that were tweaked. They were in the 91 standards, but either the scoping, meaning the number of elements that need to be accessible, or in the technical requirements, and that's, you know, what are the measurements and how do you make something accessible? A lot of those things did change. And the question was, well, if we do that, are we going to make everybody go back and retool everything? And the answer is no. So if you folks have met your compliance in terms of bricks and mortar to meet your program access requirement or new construction or whatever it was you did, if that facility is in compliance with the 1991 standards or UFAS, you don't have to do anything to it. Let me give you my favorite example. Reach ranges have changed in the 2010 standards for things like light switches, HVAC controls, and they were 54 inches in the 91 standards, but now it's 48 inches for both a front and a parallel approach. It would be ludicrous for everybody to have to go and reposition all of those light switches. And that's an incremental change. So if you have all of your stuff appropriately mounted at 54, you don't have to go in and change it. There is one thing, though, is if you do an alteration after 2012, then all of that in your existing facility has to comply with the new 2010 standards. But the key is that if you are in compliance currently with UFAS or the 91 standards, and unless you do an alteration, you do not have to make any further modifications to meet the 2010 standards, even after March 2012. I'm hoping that this is clear. Next slide, 15. Now, this is really what we're talking about is a safe harbor. And what this basically means is, for me, safe harbor to me means if the weather gets bad, you have a place where you can shelter. And that's really what this is that if you have done what you're supposed to do and you meet the requirements, you're not required to do anything further. But we are the Department of Justice, and we never say anything without saying, however, we have some exceptions to those, and those are the new supplemental requirements. And again, like I said earlier, these are requirements that are in the 2010 standards that never existed. They weren't addressed in the 91 standards. Their safe harbor does not apply to this. And the reason why is for safe harbor to apply to you folks is that you already have to be in compliance with 91 standards or UFAS. And if there weren't any scoping or technical requirements for certain things, how are you going to be in compliance? So these are new requirements, and there isn't a safe harbor. So you got to, the bottom line is you got to fix them. And the last thing is, and I know this is really hard thinking about, especially when we're talking about the supplemental requires, which are so bricks and mortar-ish, and we're talking about program access, and it's very hard, I think, for folks. It's almost like this is oil and water, and it doesn't mix. You have to look at what you need to do. Let's talk about the supplemental requirements. Using the prism of program access. And remember, Irene had said earlier that there are a number of ways to provide program access. And I completely agree with her when she said that hopefully, having to relocate a program or deliver the service differently, hopefully there are fewer and fewer of those things happening as the built environment gradually becomes more accessible. But program access, basically what it says is that when you have to look at each program, let's talk about swimming pools. Which, as you know, there's supplemental requirements for those. And for any Title II entity that has swimming pools, that's a whole program that you offer. It is your swimming program or your swimming pool program, aquatics. You've got it listed somewhere. In a line item, you've got it listed somewhere in what, if you go to your website, which is always a really interesting thing to do, is to look on your own website and see what you guys are saying you offer to the public. Because stuff changes, and you might have a webmaster that all of a sudden throws something up, and it's like, oh, I didn't know that. But this applies to the program as a whole. And I would love to see everything be made accessible. If you have 10 pools, I would love to see them all be made accessible with two accessible means of entry, you know, a lift, steps, a ramp. But the reality is that you may not be able to do that, especially right now, given significant budget constraints. So in order to make decisions, you have to assess what it is that you're doing now. And my suggestions is that you need to look at each of those pools. And I know it sounds crazy because you're thinking of pools, you know, what do I have to look at? It's a hole in the ground. But there's a reason why you put pools in the places you do. So, you know, how do people generally participate in that? How do a geographic? If you're a small community, you've got two pools, you know, that may be a little different. But if you're a larger community and you do have these 10 pools, you need to figure out where they are before you can begin an assessment. And it may be if it's a state, county by county, if you're, you know, town by town, or it could be neighborhood by neighborhood, which is very common. Where I grew up in New Hampshire, we had neighborhood pools that the city offered. The next thing is look at what is it that you offer at each of those locations. How do you advertise each of those pools? Are there some pools that, because of a certain feature, it's really geared for kids? Are there some pools where maybe a lap pool and maybe you have to be a certain age to participate, to be able to use that pool? But you need to look at who is that pool intended for? Is it intended for a specific age group, a specific population? For, as we all know in our communities, there are more and more folks with who coming in whose primary language is not spoken English. And do you make decisions based on that? There are certain things that we are going to put in certain areas, and they're designed to serve that area. And I think that's a really important consideration. Now, so once you've looked at each of your pools and where they are, what do you offer at those pools, then you need to look at which ones are accessible and to what extent are they accessible. And I think that's a really important thing to look at, because I would say that if you had a pool that was fairly close to being accessible, but you chose not to make it accessible, you know, because it would cost too much, and rather that they would go to another nearby pool, I think that might be problematic. So you need to look at what is the barrier to access. And if it's a small barrier, I think that you need to do whatever you can to remove that barrier. Because in this whole process, and I know it sounds like a lot, but in this whole process, you are required to give priority to methods of providing program access that provide your programs in the most integrated setting you can. And so that has to be an important part of that calculus. And that goes back to why are you providing pools, where you do, and what programs are you providing. Look at also at dispersal. And for a real small community, what we're looking at is how convenient are things. Is one located right in the middle of town and the other one you got to drive 5 miles? Or if you have the 10 pools, are three of them like really accessible pools because they were the last ones you built and you went ahead and did stuff? But are they all on the outskirts of town, not accessible by public transportation? So you also need to look to how do people get there. And I'll tell you, there is a reason why you put things where you do, and that has to be important part of your thinking. You can't ask folks with disabilities to, if they're even able, to get a taxi or to drive when everybody else is able to use public transportation to get to a pool. And that is an added hurdle, and I think that is different treatment. And then you look at, again, the existing barriers to participation. And I know we're talking about the built environment, but you also need to look at your policies as well to make sure that you may have some policies that on their face look just fine. You need to be careful that those policies also don't unintentionally exclude people with disabilities. So, I mean, all of those things are very important in terms of looking at and answering the question, oh, my God, what do we have to do now? So two things. One is start now, and the second is take a look at and do that assessment. Even if you don't call it a self-eval, it's fine. Call it an assessment if it makes you feel better or if it doesn't sound as onerous. But there is no possible way you can begin to look at whether you're in compliance even by March 15th, 2012 if you don't begin it now. And failure to do so, just if somebody were to file a complaint with us, and our first question is going to be, and they're going to say, well, none of the pools are accessible. Our first question to you is going to be, so let's see your self-evaluation or your assessment plan. How did you make the decisions not to do anything? And you really need to be able to show something for that. You really do, because that won't make us happy. And I know that folks who are ADA coordinators and administrators, you have a million things on your plate right now. But, you know, between now and March of 2012, compliance and assessment and evaluation of where you stand in terms of providing access to folks with disabilities, you need to be doing that now. And you really, you have to have something to show that you're trying. And are you going to, if you have to make structural changes at everything, are you going to be able to do that right away? The answer is, you know, maybe not. But even if you've gotten that far and you make that assessment, then don't let the process stop. Then say, well, here's what we can do. And Irene and I will talk to you about transition plans. But you need to look now, figure out what you can do, and start implementing things bit by bit by bit. Whenever you can. And, you know, for those who wait until, you know, March 15th of 2012, I really do think you do that at your own peril. So I think what we're going to be doing now is talking about how do you do a transition plan or whatever it is you call it, and what do you need to be thinking about, and we're trying to put this in perspective and to make it as easy as possible. And, yes, I'm from the federal government, and I'm here to help you. So with that, I think I'll turn this back to Irene.
Thanks, Sally. We know you're here to help. I remember. We're going to talk, before we get to transition plans, we're going to talk a bit about self-evaluations, and we don't have a slide for this. Forgive the oversight. But when you do a self-evaluation, you're looking at your policies. In other words, what do you officially say to your staff or to the public, if you're a city, town, state, etc.? What do you say you do with respect to people with disabilities? Or, just as important, what do you say your policies are and how do they affect people with disabilities? Because you may have policies that aren't specifically disability-related but still have an impact on people with disabilities. So you look at your policies, and then you're also looking at your practices, which are, it's sort of, what do you do on a daily basis? How do you carry out your programs? It's, you know, if you say, well, we've always done it this way, that's a practice. May not be a policy, it may not be something that's come down officially, but it's a practice, or you're also going to look at your procedures. What officially do you say is the way in which you do something? And you need to do that in all types of areas. It can be very broad-ranging, and, of course, the larger a city or a state is, the more types of activities they're likely to have. And some of the things that I'm going to talk about are going to be geared more towards larger entities, but keep in mind that you need to tailor what you do to the size and of your entity and the types of activities that you carry out. I'm currently working with teams on doing self-evaluations and transition plans for a major city and for a state university, and we're taking the same approach to these. And basically the approach is this. We work with the entity we train them to do their own self-evaluation and transition plan with our help. So the first step is to identify all the programs it's usually by department or agency. And then we train staff, we train a team from each department or agency about how to use a survey form that we develop. And that's in Excel, and it has a number of questions, and the ones that we have are numerous and detailed, again, because these are large entities. Smaller entities would probably do this a little bit differently. Once the training happens, we ask the teams to, based on the knowledge they've gained, go back and identify the programs again and see if these really are individual programs. And by programs, you know, that the definition of that's kind of elusive, but what we mean is a particular identifiable activity or service or sort of a cluster of activities or services that have common elements and that are carried out or administered in the same way. Then the department teams or agency teams fill out the survey form for each program, and they do this in Excel, and then they have a database from which to work. So, for example, here are the kinds of things that are covered. We have a section on the application process. In other words, if people need to file an application in order to participate in a program or service, how do you carry that out? We have one on eligibility to participate. We have one on testing. One that would apply to almost any kind of entity is hearings, meetings, trainings, classes, tours, and special events. Modifications of policies, specialized programs. Do you have, for example, a wheelchair basketball league in the city? Then we ask you to analyze that according to the provisions of the ADA with respect to most integrated setting and specialized programs. Communication, including in-person communication, written communication, oral communication, telephone, electronic communication, websites, maintenance of features, transportation, emergency procedures. So all of these are the kinds of things that almost any entity would need to evaluate. And then other areas that are specific and that some of the small towns might not have is housing. Sally mentioned recreation activities like pools. Those are something that are covered as well. City sheltering programs for people who are homeless or have survived or are victims of domestic violence. Access to libraries. Community policing and community policing meetings. So what we do is we ask each team to sit down with people in the know within their department or agency, and we sit down with them when they do the first couple of these and go through this whole series of questions. And the first stage is gathering information. And we try to emphasize to people that you're not making decisions and recommendations at that point. You're gathering information. You're detecting whether there are problems. So, for example, and I'm just going to give you a couple of these so that we can get to questions pretty soon. We may ask, let's take service animals because that's one of the areas that's changed in the new regulation. We have a section on modifications of policies, and one question is, can a person ask for changes to a policy or procedure? And then yes or no, and then if the answer is yes, how do you decide whether to agree to modify the program, the policy, or procedure? And the next question is, do you allow service animals in all locations where a service is offered to the public? And then we have more specific questions, do you limit the questions that can be asked? And, of course, we say what those questions are under the regulations. Do you require a special permit? Do you require a vest? Of course, the answers to those two should be no. Do you charge fees? And then is your staff trained on these? And for meetings, we'll ask, are they always held in an accessible location? If they're not, do you move them? How much notice do you require? What kinds of notice do you give to people, et cetera? And we go through those kinds of questions with every single category, which then gives you a database, which I think is essential for any kind of decision that you're going to make. And, again, if you're a small town or a small county, you're not going to ask as many detailed questions. You're not going to be covering as many areas, but this is a model that seems to work well, at least so far, with a larger city, and I think it would also work with a city of moderate size and with almost any size of university. So then once you can be doing a transition plan and a self-evaluation either concurrently or you can do them separately. And if we go on to slide 17, we mentioned that there are several ways to do a transition plan. And I remember when we were at Justice, and Sally, you're probably still having these conversations, the question was, do you look at the program and then look at each facility used in the program, or do you look at each facility and figure out how it's used in one or more programs? Do you follow the program or do you follow the facility?
Irene?
Yes.
Yes, indeed, we do still get those questions.
And do you have an answer?
I say whatever works best for you.
Absolutely. I would say the same thing. And I think generally a hybrid is going to work for most instances where you're considering both the facilities and how they're used at the same time. And it can get tricky. It can get difficult. You can get mired down in a lot of detail. And I think part of the trick is knowing your own programs, working with someone who, if you don't have in-house ability, working with someone who thoroughly understands the requirements to the extent they can be understood.
Hey.
And figuring out what works for you, which leads us to, on slide 18, we say do what works for you. There are various models. It's important, whatever you do, to identify what you've done as a self-evaluation, as a transition plan, or if you're a Title III entity, as a barrier removal plan. You know, don't be in the position where somebody says, did you do one? And you say, well, we talked about it. We might have something somewhere. You need to have it labeled as your transition plan or your self-evaluation. And when you're doing a transition plan, it's important to look at how policies affect access to facilities. In other words, you can have a beautifully, perfectly accessible facility, but if you lock the accessible entrance, keep the inaccessible entrance open, or if you don't maintain features to be accessible, then you're basically creating barriers. And you also have to look at outside entities who work with you, who may supply the porta-potties at events, or who may actually carry out some of your programs, such as homeless shelters, child care, et cetera, because you are responsible for what they do. It's important to consider them and include them in your planning and your evaluation to the same extent you include the things that you do directly with your own staff. So, Sally, do you want to chime in here and give us the benefit of your experience before we go on to...
I think... I really do, and I agree that the hybrid is probably the way to go, if you can. But then there are some things that I think you need to look at, because remember earlier we talked about that relocating or moving, you know, or delivering the service differently is one way to achieve program access. But I think you need to look at, there are some things that you can't deliver it differently. And I think you need to look at those and perhaps identify those. And that all goes back to why you offer the programs you do in the way that you do. Because there was some thought process, even if it's, well, we've always done it this way for, you know, 96 years, there's a reason why you do things the way you do, and I think you need to look at those, because if you use other methods other than architectural changes, one thing that I really want to caution folks about is that if you deliver the service differently, or if you relocate where to an accessible location where somebody can access that program, activity, or service, you have to make sure that they're basically equal services, that the same terms and conditions. For instance, I mean, if I have to come and register my car, and it's always been that room on the second floor of my town hall, and there's no elevator, if they couldn't remove a barrier, but it would meet the program access requirement for them to come down and say, we can do this in the lobby. However, if that same town hall houses on that inaccessible second floor a group counseling sessions for survivors of rape, you shouldn't be able to say to me that, we'll talk to you one-on-one in the lobby. So there's two things that would be incredibly wrong with that. One is what is the benefit of the program? And you don't have group therapy or group counseling just to have it. There is a different kind of benefit, and it's a different kind of a format. And it's always done behind closed doors. So meeting me in the lobby to talk one-on-one, you pretty much get two big red X's, because it's not the same program, and it's not under the same terms and conditions. So I think you need to be thinking of, again, how do we offer this program generally, and how do people participate? And if you think it's important to do something in a specific way, you have to make sure that you do that in a specific way that is inclusive of people with disabilities as well.
And along those same lines, you've talked about how the relationship of the facilities, the activity is so critical. Sometimes it's the neighborhood that matters also. For example, all around the country, we have community policing programs. And, you may live in a neighborhood where there's been, maybe a rash of breaking of windows of cars at night or a series of violent attacks. And the police will call a meeting at the local school or the church or whatever for those in the community. Well, if that's not accessible, it's going to be hard to, you're not going to necessarily want to move that to the neighboring community. If that's the only accessible location you have. So you need to have planned in advance for an accessible location. And by accessible, I mean not just accessible to people with disabilities, but accessible to the community and the people with disabilities in the community. So in that sense, it's very closely tied to the particular community. And another area where this comes up in higher ed is housing. Residence halls more and more have special, so to speak, programs housed in them. There may be tutoring. There may be a foreign language house, a French house, or a Spanish house, a residence hall that's favored by most of the athletes. People may prefer to be in a certain location. All those factors come into play when you're assessing whether the housing that's offered to students and faculty even with disabilities in higher education are accessible. So all these factors need to be taken into account. Sally, are we ready to take questions?
I think so.
Go ahead.
All right. Great. Irene, we'll have the operator go ahead and give some instructions to people about that, and then we can take those questions from folks. So why don't we go ahead and do that right now?
Ladies and gentlemen, if you have a question at this time, please press star then one on your touch-tone telephone. If your question has been answered or you wish to remove yourself from the queue, please press the pound key. Again, if you have a question, please press star then one on your touch-tone telephone.
While we're waiting for people to do that, Irene and Sally, I've got a couple of questions that have been submitted already through the electronic means. One of them is I have participants asking whether or not you know of, either one of you, any cities, towns, or states that you find to be more progressive with compliance, with, you know, that may have already started to look at the new regulations and such that you might, you know, recommend for somebody who's looking for, you know, some best practices or whatever? Are you, either one of you, familiar? I know it's kind of difficult to name names and such, but are you aware of anything?
I can mention one or two things, I think. Now, I don't know what they've done in light of the new regulations, but when I'm looking for good practices, I find that the City and County of San Francisco is a good place to look. And I didn't ask them if I could say this, but they have some pretty detailed policies and practices and checklists for special events, for example. And they developed their own self-evaluation. I would go online and Google and see what you can find. There are some good examples out there.
When you say they've developed their own self-evaluation, one of the other questions that was asked is, do you have any tools or recommended tools, checklists, et cetera, that would be available to entities to do this kind of thing?
You know, this is the eternal burning question.
Yep.
The DIBTACS, the New England Center, Adaptive Environments, what used to be Adaptive Environments, did the ADA Title II Action Guide when the original regulations came out. And I think that's still one of the most helpful guides, although it's not terribly detailed, and, of course, it's not in Excel or anything like that. I don't know. A lot of the cities have copyrighted or don't necessarily make available their checklists, but I know San Francisco's is online, and I think that's a good place to start. And I'm hoping that more will be developed as time goes on. I don't know, Sally, if you know of any?
Well, I mean, we have just in on our ADA website, which is www.ada.gov, we do have a toolkit, and it's under Project Civic Access. And if you don't know about it, it's we have the authority to do compliance reviews at a town near you. We've developed seven chapters of it's called the PCA Toolkit, and it's online. And Chapter 2 deals with, you know, ADA coordinator stuff, notices, grievance procedure, administrative requirements under the ADA. I've seen an awful lot of private stuff, and I can't speak to their accuracy. Irene, what about NADAC? Do they have stuff on there?
No. Okay. No, they haven't developed it. But I think the toolkit is a great place to start. It's not complete yet, but I think Chapter 2 with the procedural bits, I think the information Justice has developed for emergency shelters is absolutely outstanding, and I think it's the right level of detail to use for those purposes. And the other sections in communication is well done as well. But yeah, I would definitely use that to the extent that, you know, the parts of that are done are just great, I think. We found that we had to basically draw from what other people had done and come up with our own approach to this. There's just nothing that's comprehensive, I guess, yet.
Yeah, and I think one of the struggles is because every entity is different. I think that some of the struggles of not having something that is, you know, uniform or out there is because there is some need to kind of customize or look at for yourself and what works with your organization and how you approach it and what you're going about. Oftentimes I think entities are looking for cookie cutter, and it doesn't always work a cookie cutter in these situations because programs and services do differ, or how you're organized, you know, does differ.
Right. Yep. Yeah.
One of the other questions that we have here is, I think as you've alluded in some of your comments to the preamble, for the Title II regulations, and we have somebody who's asking about whether or not this is actually posted on ADA.gov and where they would find it. So, Sally, can you do you want to give anybody some specificity to how might find that? Because there's so much information on your website to try to find this particular document. Do you have any suggestions for people? I think that's what they're asking.
There's a couple of things. One is that we have, first of all, we have print copies available. We we just, a month ago, I guess, were able to print the fully integrated regulations. Now, up on our website, there's two things you want to look at. Right now on our website, we have an HTML version of the integrated regulation, which basically means the regulations that were published last September are not the full Title II reg. What they are is they're additions and changes, so only that was published, not the full regulation. So here's a suggestion, is look at the Federal Register version on the web, and you'll find it. It's right near the top of the homepage for regulations, and that will have the language, the guidance or preamble. It's now called guidance. Section-by-section analysis, that relate to the new provisions. All of the text of the other parts of the regulation and the old preamble stayed the same. We are hoping in the very, well, in the relatively near future, we are DOJ after all, to be able to publish HTML versions and a PDF version of our printed reg, which includes everything. And it also includes the 1991 preamble, so people can have that as well. But we don't have a complete reg document up there yet.
Great, thank you. Why don't we go ahead and take some questions from our call-in participants, please?
We have a question from the state of Indiana.
Go ahead.
Sally and Irene, thanks for holding it. I had two questions if I can. One is real quick. Does the integrated regulation, does that include the corrections that were just released?
No.
Okay. My question was, if a particular state agency chooses to use the 2010 standards right now, does this obligate another state agency to use the 2010s as well?
My answer to that would be no, because it's not necessarily by agency, because the standards deal with the built environment and facilities and buildings. So, I mean, you have the choice of using 91, 2010, or UFAS for each facility, and you have to stick with that throughout that facility.
Right. But if it was a particular agency, let's say, for example, the Bureau of Motor Vehicles decided to use 2010 and their new construction, would the Department of Corrections have to use 2010 right now?
I do not believe they would. I don't see any connection, Irene.
I read that the same way you do, Sally.
Great. Thank you.
Our next question comes from ADA Ohio.
Go ahead.
Hello. Actually, you answered our question, so you can give the floor to somebody else. Just a hello to Irene and Sally.
Thank you, Scott.
That was Scott.
That was Scott Lichtner, if anybody wants to know, with the compliance office at Ohio State University that was talking there that people were saying hello to. I do have an online question I want to slip in here at this point. We have a bricks and mortar question, as they say. If a facility is not in compliance with the 1991 standards or UFAS, and a program offered in that facility has been made accessible through alternative methods, do alterations have to be undertaken to bring the facility into compliance with the 2010 standards?
Okay, let me give the official answer. Is no, because you're looking at in terms of program access. So, but what I would caution is that now is a wonderful time to look at, are we really offering these things in an integrated setting? Irene?
I totally agree with you.
Oh, my gosh.
So, for example, in this case, let's say that they were offering it through an alternative means, such as, let's say, maybe a home visit instead of actually having the person come. That could be an issue of what you're saying, the integrated setting, because if everyone else is coming and has the benefits of the other interactions and things that occur by coming to a site, that is something they should readdress.
I think they should because, you know, integration, it's so key in the ADA, and it's specifically mentioned. And, you know, things may have changed now. And, you know, maybe they're able to either offer that whole program in an accessible facility or make some other changes. An assessment is still due.
Right. You're talking about, at heart, this is about program accessibility and whether you're actually achieving program accessibility. And as Sally has suggested, and I think it's wonderful to emphasize this, integrated setting is important, socialization is important, confidentiality, all those factors go into whether you're achieving true program accessibility. And if you're not, then, yes, you will have to bring up upgrade the facilities to bring them up to the standards. But I think you go back to that first core question, what is program accessibility and have we achieved it?
And if I could add one thing, I mean, when you look at when the ADA regs were promulgated back in the early 90s, nobody was in compliance with anything. And I think that there was a very different expectation then. Because the built environment was incredibly hostile from decades of neglect. And I think that there's a different expectation this time around. I think that perhaps local governments may have more alternatives now. Is it perhaps less convenient? Maybe, but I don't think that is a benchmark for deciding what program access truly is.
I want to mention something that we haven't uttered. We haven't uttered these words yet, but I think we have an obligation to mention it. Program accessibility has some limits, I guess you would call them.
Yep.
You don't have to do anything that would cause an undue financial administrative burden. You don't have to do anything that would fundamentally alter the nature of a program. So, you know, we're talking about the ideal in many respects here. It's ideal to have the most integrated setting and the same level of confidentiality and the same level of socialization and convenience and all of that. But part of what you do in a self-evaluation and transition plan is to make decisions. You gather the information. You decide whether you've really achieved program accessibility. And if you haven't, you decide what you're going to do to work towards that goal, but you do have those limits. And especially when everyone is struggling with decreased resources, you then make decisions about what you're going to do and what you aren't going to do. And at the same time, you don't throw up your hands and say, it costs too much, I'm not going to do anything. If you decide to take advantage, so to speak, of those limitations, you need to do that in writing. You have to have the head of the agency or somebody who holds the purse strings put in writing what the decisions are that you've decided to, for example, you've decided to make these 3 out of 8 pools or libraries or whatever accessible in this way, and the reason you're not doing the others, even though it would be required for full program accessibility, is you give your reasons, you document that. You make sure that you've considered all the funds that are available and then put that in your plan, put that in your self-evaluation. That's required by the regulation, and it also is one of the measures that will help protect you from liability if anyone challenges you. I mean, I don't want to sound like we think, you know, all of your resources have to go towards this, but there are those limits that are written into the regulation.
Yeah, I agree completely, and, yep, sometimes we do talk about the ideal situation, but the ideal is what hopefully we need to strive for.
Yep.
It doesn't mean you're always going to meet it, or that you'll, you know, really be able to meet it, you know, in a lot of situations. So, yeah, I just want to echo what Irene said, that there are limitations or defenses should you need to have a defense.
And you may say in your self-evaluation and transition plan, here's what we've done and here's what we know we need to do.
Yep.
We're going to make these 3 things our priorities in the next 5 years. You know, state what goals you're working towards and how you plan to achieve those.
Okay. Next question, please.
Again, ladies and gentlemen, if you have a question, please press star then one on your touchtone telephone.
So does that mean we have kind of a silent group there today? Many obviously questions and things of that nature. Maybe they're pondering or they're overwhelmed, as all of us are by this. If you had any one suggestion for a Title II entity, let's say that has never gone through, even though they were required and those quote-unquote requirements have now come and gone, and I know you made comment to this in the beginning about this issue, but if you had any one recommendation for a Title II entity, whether it be a local government or be a state, around how to approach the compliance today, 20 years after the implementation of the ADA, in light of the new regulations at this time, what would that be, both Sally and Irene, if you want to take a stab at that?
I'll make one suggestion. If you've never done anything and you're not going to know how well you're doing necessarily, I would reach out to the community and start there. You could start by asking people to come into contact with city workers to fill out a survey or to answer some questions or to do it online. And it wouldn't necessarily be people with visible disabilities because most disabilities aren't. Or start with a community or public meeting to sort of start assessing where you are and where you need to go, and then come up with a reasonable planned approach that works with you. And that last part I know is really fuzzy and vague. But I wouldn't just sort of think, nothing's going to happen. We've never had to do much before. Another piece is to look at those things you do where you have the most interaction with the public and start evaluating how successful those are, how effective those are for people with disabilities, and look at communication. Look at what you do for public meetings, for web communication and your written publications. Those are just some ideas.
I have a couple. I think the first would be is to take a deep breath.
Right.
And just, first of all, don't believe everything you hear except from Irene and me or everything you read. And I think that you need to know what questions you're going to, if you're going to, and I think outreach is incredibly important, and not just to folks with disabilities, but also to, the baby boomers and the aging population, because I think one thing is don't assume that you know what the priorities might be. And it may be something that you think, well, this is like the biggest, it's going to cost the most money, so that maybe should be our first priority. When you get feedback from folks who need those accessible features, they'll say, no, I could care less about that right now. Here are the big issues. So when you do outreach and you look at, I think you have to go back and look at, who are the audiences that you're trying to provide services and programs and activities for? And that's going to help you identify who you need to get feedback from. Sometimes if you get feedback just from a wide open space, you need to be careful what you wish for. And I think if you can identify who users are and talk with them about, specific programs or facilities, I think that's very helpful. But the important thing is to act, and I think, probably folks that are out there and are ADA coordinators, a whole lot of you weren't ADA coordinators back, when the self-eval and the transition plan was due 18 years ago. So the important thing now is to just begin. And I would suggest that you reach out to other ADA coordinators or whoever might have that title, or to all those folks who have these duties in their other duties as assigned category. But talk with others, and we're all going to make mistakes, and I think perhaps that's the most important thing. And the important thing is that you start to plan, you start to assess, you start to do an eval, and yeah, you're going to make mistakes. I mean, who isn't? And just be prepared to fix those mistakes. And even if you do make mistakes, our interest here at the department is stopping a discriminatory practice, which may be an inaccessible built environment, a policy or a practice. And what we care about is fixing that problem. And that's our interest. And if you have done the best you can and it's clear that you've tried, we're not going to be seeking penalties or seeking financial compensation. But I'll tell you what, we will be seeking them if it's very clear that nothing has been done, not just for this time around, but for the last time.
As a follow-up to that, Sally, because we're almost at the end of the hour, do you see or can you give any thoughts, and maybe you don't want to, you know, tip the card or anything, but what DOJ's approach is going to be towards monitoring Title 20 entities at this time? I mean, given the heightened awareness with the new regulations and the compliance and the, you know, effective dates and such of that nature, do you have any sense of whether or not there is going to be some stepped-up monitoring going on at all, or just going on as you have, which has already stepped up in this administration already, but just if you could give any thoughts on that?
Well, I don't know in terms of monitoring, because we're not going to go in. We're not going to go to a Title II entity and say, all right, how are you doing with all of this stuff, unless we have an intention to do a compliance review. So I think a lot of this is still going to be what we get for complaints from folks who are living in these communities, what we hear. And we hear a lot, you know, and from folks, quote, on the outside. But certainly the expectation is that, especially the second time around, yes, people are going to make mistakes, but I wouldn't be surprised if we don't do additional litigation, if people won't settle.
Yeah, okay. I think that's good thoughts. Well, we are at the bottom of the hour. What's always the problem with these things is we do end up having a lot of dialogue, and we do end up running out of time. We are at the 2:30 mark, and I want to thank all of our participants for their engagement with us today and their participation with us. Just as a reminder to people that our next session, which is in April, that session will be covering the recreation areas, and we'll be given specific focus on the new areas of recreation that are in the 2010 standards. And one of the points of discussion there will be, you know, how do I begin to look at those issues for compliance? And you heard our presenters today talk about the issues of safe harbor and what does and does not apply to those things. Our speaker, which includes the new issues of the new recreation areas, our speaker for next month's session is Jennifer Skaluski, who is with the National Center on Accessibility and does a great deal of work in the area of accessibility of the recreation environment. So I invite you to join us for that session, and you can go to the website, www.ada-audio.org, to register for that particular session, and we invite you and hope that you will come and join us for that session. I also at this time would like to remind people of the upcoming events. One most importantly is the National ADA Symposium, which is scheduled in May of this year. It is in Las Vegas, and this year this is a annual event that is sponsored by the networks, ADA National Network, and this year it is on the 9th, 10th, and 11th of May. Registration for that event is available online as well. For those of you who have not had an opportunity to are not familiar with it, it's adasymposium.org, all one word, and you can get all the information you need. Great room rates, as low as $59 a night. Registration, early registration, $50, and then it goes up after that, so up to $600. So you may want to think about that. You may also want to contact your regional ADA center to see if any scholarships or any stipends are available to attend. So I really do encourage people to look to that as a national event. And I know, Sally, you will be there and be presenting presenting, and I know you will be covering some of the new regulations and things of that nature as part of your presentations and such. So I do want to just make people aware of that. So this concludes our session today. You will receive a follow-up email with the evaluation link. We do encourage you to give us feedback. We use your feedback to try to improve our program and such, so please take some time to fill that out. And before we leave today, I do want to extend a huge line of thanks on behalf of the ADNA National Network and our participants to both Sally and Irene for sharing your expertise today and being frank with us in your discussion on this particular topic. There is a lot more to be learned by all of us, and it's an ongoing compliance issue that we all deal with on a day-to-day basis. So thank you very much, and everyone, have a great rest of your day. And as I said, this session was recorded and will be available within 5 to 7 business days on our website at the www.ada-audio.org in the archive area. Again, thank you very much, and you can now hang up your phone or disconnect your computer. Thank you.
Thanks, Robin.
Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for your participation in today's conference. This concludes the conference, and you may now disconnect.